You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Hi, my name is Tom Nguyen. I am a managing partner at Key Partners. I've been a commercial real estate broker for about 22 years, commercial real estate investment broker, investor myself, and also a developer.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
Thanks, Tom. Congratulations on the recent VNARP recognition awards to the highest producing Vietnamese real estate salesperson here in the U.S. This is a huge distinction. And it's important to recognize this. And I, you know, wanted to invite you on for years now because we've known each other since the mid 90s, actually.
Since college days, right?
College days. And to see you climb this way, you know, I've tracked your progress throughout the years and we have a lot of mutual friends. So this is a big, really to beat out all the Vietnamese brokers and agents in the United States. That's a huge deal. And we'll definitely get into that. You know, there are thousands of brokers and agents in our community, in our Vietnamese community. What kind of things about you had allowed you to get this far?
Well, I think we have to differentiate between residential and commercial. Because there's the majority of people in real estate are in residential real estate and they're just totally different animals. I think the skill set in commercial is very broad. You know, I'm an attorney by trade, you know, I'm a licensed attorney. That definitely helps. Residential, it's very simple, right? You can buy a house, you can fix it up. And you can add value that way. But in commercial, there's so many myriad of tools that you can use to add value to a commercial property. So if you're able to identify certain opportunities and employ a lot of these different techniques to add value to commercial real estate, then you can become successful. And that's kind of the key to it.
What kind of added value things are we looking at? I mean, I don't want you to do a secret sauce, but what are the few things that you look for?
I think in commercial real estate is very unique. And I just want to go back on that. There's a lot of Vietnamese people or Asians in residential real estate. There's very little of us in commercial real estate. Mm. I mean, I could probably count them on one hand, especially Vietnamese. I'm not sure what the reason for that is, but I think one is lack of exposure. You know, I think people just don't understand. You go to your local grocery store, you know, you go to Albertsons or you go to Whole Foods, and you just don't know that those centers that you're going into are actually bought and sold, like quite often.
Oh, really?
And brokers like myself trade them for large investors and sellers. And that Whole Foods probably used to be occupied by a Kmart, or as a vacant, you know, Macy's or something like that. You know, some broker bought that property with a vacancy and brought Whole Foods in. And increase the value by so much. So that's an example of a tool you could use. I think in commercial real estate, the concept of one person's trash is another person's treasure is really true in commercial real estate, because you can rezone the property. And, you know, it can be an office building. Right now, the office market is getting trashed because of COVID. So we're looking at office buildings for the land value. But if you can change that office building on land and convert it to residential, just by the stroke of a pen, by city approval, getting entitlements, the property goes up by that much without putting any sticks in the ground yet, you know. And once you build it, of course, it goes up more. But those are the type of tools that you can use if you know the cities, where the cities are leaning towards, what can get approved, or if you have a tenant in tow, like a Whole Foods or like a Chick-fil-A or something like that, then you can really add value to property. And it's still inefficient, you know. So that's where you can play in a market that's not efficient. Like the stock market's efficient. If you bought a stock and you know what it's trading at, you can sell it or buy it right then and there.
Yeah. Yeah.
In commercial real estate, things move slower. There's a lot of laws and there's a lot of tenants involved. So to navigate it, you can add value in many ways because the markets are not, they're still not efficient. In the residential market is pretty efficient.
Right, right.
You know, there's comps and things like that. But, you know, how do you value an empty office building? Someone trying to get out of that because they're paying mortgage and they don't have any income. Someone's trying to get out of that, but someone's trying to get into that to convert it to something else. So that's kind of
And that's probably why we don't see a whole lot of Vietnamese people in the commercial real estate game, because of that sort of complexity and the weight, the weighting that's involved. And you really need to have a creative side to your brain to reimagine how it could be reused in another situation, right?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's not impossible, but I think it's the barriers to entry are a little higher than residential. But it's, you know, I want to get more Asians involved, you know, especially Vietnamese.
Why do you want to get more Asians and Vietnamese involved? What does that do for the overall environment ecosystem of the real estate game?
It's just kind of a pride thing. I think the commercial real estate industry is one of the last industries that is still really dominated by white Caucasian males. I mean, literally, if you go to a CBRE office, or you go to like a Cushman & Wakefield office, these are big commercial real estate firms. They're all older white men and younger, you know, their nieces, their nephews that come in and get into the industry. It's really like a, you know, it's really kind of a boys club, you know. Yeah. So I want more diversity, and there's very sophisticated Vietnamese and Asians out there that can do this kind of work, especially at least on the investment side, you know, or develop, like even the development business, there's not a lot of Asians in it. You know, if you're not going to come in on the transactional side, at least come in and invest in commercial real estate, with someone like me or you know, a larger firm or something like that. But
okay, well, let me ask you this, Tom. The commercial real estate, this is just me, I'm a layman, I don't, you know, this is not my my world, but when I drive down these main boulevards, like in Pasadena, Beverly Hills, or in Orange County, some places, there are so many for lease signs that I'm seeing as a result of, who knows, but I'm guessing that the economy of Amazon and all of these online retailers are really killing the retail space and the retail commercial spaces. That's just a guess from a layman's perspective. So I want to really get into this because I'm curious about how it affects your life, how it affects the future of mom and pop businesses that we used to depend so much as the engine of economic activity here in the United States. All of it is being wiped out by these massive corporations like Amazon. And now it's really disintegrated the landscape. So I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so It's weird because the commercial real estate industry has transformed a lot in the last 5 years, even, right? So, even 5 years ago, industrial properties were like, okay, maybe like 8 years ago, industrial properties were like the worst properties there were. So they're like the lowest cost. They're in like the worst areas. They're just basically warehouses and stuff like that. So commercial real estate investors kind of, never thought about purchasing those warehouses in industrial space. They were only purchased for people who like had businesses, they weren't purchased for investments, right? But now the industrial market, industrial buildings are basically the best product out there because of Amazon. And there's two things, because of Amazon and because of COVID, right? So Amazon basically came along and started buying up all these warehouses because they need to basically distribute. If you're doing e-commerce, you don't have a storefront, you need to get your goods into a warehouse and ship them. So there's all these distribution warehouses that they need. And the more they want to get it quicker to you, the closer the warehouses have to be to your home. So they're not out in the San Bernardino anymore. They're right here because they want to get the last mile delivery. They want to deliver it to you in like 15 minutes eventually. So the warehouse, the storage has to be very close. So all the industrial properties just shot up.
Wow.
They're like 3x what they used to be. It's crazy. So, and then on the reverse side, the office market used to be the top of the industry. I mean, those buildings in San Francisco, those high rise buildings in San Francisco were, Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff occupied, had the highest rents in the country. Now they're like ghost towns. Okay. And COVID also caused a huge logistics problem because retailers and e-commerce were so dependent on foreign goods from China and things like that. So COVID, when China shut down, we had a huge supply chain issue. So you notice that Target didn't have anything on their shelves and stuff like that. There's like people had a problem getting goods. So what's the result of that? You need more warehousing, more storage, because they want to store everything. Let's say they ship everything over here. They'll ship excess over here and store it here so they don't rely on foreign shipments because of COVID. So now that even increases the warehousing issue. So now you own a warehouse, you're golden. I know one of my friends, for instance, they manufactured like paintball supplies, and his business wasn't doing so well, but luckily, he bought a warehouse to do his business in like 6 years ago, and he bought it with an SBA loan at 10% down or something. He bought it for like $1.2 million back then with 10% down. So you talk about like $120,000. His business wasn't doing so well, so he decided to sell. He shut down the business, tried to sell off his assets, and he sold that building for $8 million. So you basically, he put $120,000 down and he turned it into like a $7.5 million gain. Right?
That's insane, the
numbers are just like,
it doesn't make sense.
It doesn't, because of leverage too. The beauty of commercial real estate is you have leverage, because you can use a lender's money to buy something and the property goes up.
That's like pure luck though. I mean, that's like timing in the world with COVID and Amazon coming. You can't plan for something like that, right? In life.
Yep. There is pure luck in that. That's the case of pure luck, but the majority of commercial real estate is not luck. I'll just give you an example. One of my clients owns a a piece of land on Bristol, and right across from Santa Ana College. And he called me one day and said, "Hey, I have this piece of land. It's been sitting there for a while. What should I do with it?" You know. And I, you know, I analyzed it and I said, "Well, you know, it's right across from the college. Bristol's a big street. You know, I checked the zoning. I think you can put a drive-through restaurant there, you know." And so I called up Chick-fil-A, I called up Raising Cane, and I presented them the deal. It was a little bit too small for Chick-fil-A, but Raising Cane took the deal. They're gonna do a ground lease where Raising Cane will basically build their building, and they're just gonna lease the land, right? So so the landowner basically, because of Raising Cane, that property's gone up three times. He puts no money into construction because Raising Cane's gonna build it, and they're gonna just lease the land for the next 30 years, and he's gonna have residual income for it. I mean, and that's not luck. I mean, it is luck that he owns the property, but it's not luck because we're adding value to the property.
That shows that you need to bring in somebody like you to kind of have that expertise, that creativity, and the book of accounts, the book of contacts to make a call to a Chick-fil-A or a Raising Cane, right? Yeah. So that's some high level way of thinking of selling something, because you're repurposing it, you're establishing a different use for it.
Yeah. And that's the big thing about commercial real estate. You can change uses or add tenants, or, you know, there's just so many different things. So, you know, we just purchased the Los Cabos Sports Club, and we purchased it honestly to build hundreds of units on it. But in the meantime, we discovered pickleball. You know, so Los Cab is a tennis club. It's one of the largest tennis clubs out there. But this whole pickleball phenomenon, we converted a good number of courts to 39 pickleball courts. So now the largest pickleball arena in Southern California. And we signed up over 1,500 monthly pickleball players in 2 months. It's freaking... I didn't even know pickleball existed until we purchased the Los Cabos Sports Club. It's
insane.
It's insane. It's insane. So, yeah. But you should come out and play with it. I just started picking it up. It's really addictive. It's fun, I can see why. Yeah, I can see why.
But who comes up with that idea? Is it you, your team? I mean, who had that idea to convert into a pickleball club?
When we purchased the club and we took over operations, I think it just, people were telling us that you guys should convert, you know, people tell you, and you kind of research it, and you say, you know, we got to ride the wave, you know? Yeah,
but then how do you know that there is a calculus behind the signups, right? How do you figure that out, that, you know, we get X amount of registrations, you know, and then you get 1,500, and then now it's like a thing. It's like a real business model. How did you, how do you figure that out?
You know, I don't think we ever expected to get 1,500 members in 2 months. I thought we were going to get like maybe 200 members, you know, but it was relatively low cost to convert. And then we attracted the PPA tour here, which is kind of like the Wimbledon of pickleball. It's a professional tour, and they actually converted half our course for us at their cost, because they don't have a venue big enough to house their tournament. So they actually have to create venues, you know. So you know that was this is just all very fortunate, you know. And we also converted one of the basketball courts to a wedding and banquet facility, and you know, VNARP had their gala there, and we have weddings there all the time. So, you know, basketball courts have super high ceilings.
Yeah.
And then there was an outdoor volleyball court that we converted to a wedding kind of ceremony space. So you know, the sports club is getting to a point where we might not even develop it, you know, because we Maybe it's better as a sports club, you know. It's
so you're talking about a lot of wins and a lot of wins that seem like it's lucky, but it's not. There's hands and there's thoughts behind, minds behind the conversion of these properties. But there's got to be some times where you miscalculated in your last 10, 15 years in your career. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like some big losses?
I had a huge loss like 3 years ago where, you know, we bought a piece of land, a large piece of land, almost 100 acres, a really prime location. We were a little bit aggressive in terms of, you know, land is hard to acquire because it's hard to finance because there's no income on it. Usually the seller carries, you know, the seller gives you a loan. So we were very unlucky with that because the Indian tribes, we went out to do a big industrial development. We would have made a ton of money on it because industrial was just starting to happen. But this is probably the worst deal I've ever been in. The Indian tribes next door, the Pechanga tribe and the Sodoba tribe, basically said that we have artifacts on our land. And they sued saying, you cannot develop. This is right on the freeway too. It's like prime real estate. You cannot develop on that land. And they hired like the biggest law firm in the country to basically tell us that we cannot develop on that land because of some artifacts, and they won't even provide proof of the artifacts. They won't even let us touch our own land that we bought to dig it up.
Wow.
To even study. Yeah. And
why wouldn't you go to court to fight that?
We did eventually go to court to fight it, and the city was actually helping us. But you can't afford to fight for too long in litigation. So we ended up giving it back to the seller, you know, and we took a pretty significant loss because it's just eventually that property is probably going to get developed because the city's going to fight and they're probably going to win, you know, whatnot. But who can outlast, you know,
Indian casino money?
Those are deep pockets. You know, and they can outlast you on any fight. You're just draining cash the whole time. So I mean so the losses are there. You know, but I think that I've learned from certain mistakes, and over the years we definitely have seen all the red flags. I believe there is. You know, so
with
the hopefully that doesn't repeat itself.
With the sellers of that property, you couldn't be like suing them because they didn't tell
you.
Yeah,
we did sue them. We did sue them.
Because they had to know, right?
Yeah, but it's hard to prove if they do. If they never developed it, they held it. They had it in their family for 60 years and they've never developed it. So, you know, they're
that's
just
a red flag, no.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. But, that, you know, it's kind of in a growth area. So there's a lot of vacant area land in that area. So it's not like in the middle of Orange County or anything like that. But yeah. So that's the last deal I do at Ausburgs. The only deals I would do now are in dense infill areas where there has been development in the past and things like that. So that's the last time I touched something like that again. But it was very tempting because the basis was so low. So
got it. So you had just come off a few weeks ago with this huge event, the VNARP, which is a big real estate dinner that recognize all of the high producing people in your real estate industry. Can you tell me a little bit about the significance and the history of VNARP and why it was so pronounced in the community and here in Orange County?
I just learned about VNR probably 6 months ago, and they invited me to be on the board. But from what I've known, they're they're very well organized. The people that started it are pretty big players in the residential side, at least. I think they're the owners of like franchises that have like 600 residential agents, you know, Keller Williams offices and things like that. It's a very well organized, very very ambitious group. Their mission is to bring everybody together, especially the real estate industry in the Vietnamese is so large, especially on the residential. I mean, yeah. There's everyone is a residential agent, and it's really good to have a group that brings everybody together and educates and networks, because a lot of people are looking to learn from others. For instance, a lot of people wanted to learn about commercial real estate, so I think that's a big reason why they invited me on, because everybody wants to learn, at least learn about commercial real estate, because all they know is residential. But that's a big benefit of having a group like that, because you can learn from others, and people entering the business can learn from seniors, and you can also network. And they kind of brought up their standards are really high in terms of their productions, and their gala is huge. I mean, they spent a lot of money on it. They had really good entertainment, really good food. I think it's a really good thing for the real estate market, the VNR.
Yeah, it's such a blessing to see that powerful group in our community and happening here in the state of California, because I think those guys are from the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, yeah, and they do big deals up there. To bring all that energy down here to Southern California and unite the Vietnamese real estate community is a very powerful thing. And, you know, we are all at the start of these massive movements to work together, and that's not something that has been traditionally done in the Vietnamese community due to trauma.
I agree with that.
Scarcity, all of that. We want to yonge. We want to hide what we know, and we don't want to share to push other people and uplift every. And I think second generation, we're still getting rid of those bugs in our community, but I think it's starting to show more in terms of like working together, like other communities, like the Korean and Taiwanese communities that exist in powerful ways.
Yeah, people like yourself and that are bringing people together, exposing other Vietnamese people. VNR, but you know, in my industry, for instance, I represent a lot of Chinese, a lot of institutional money, and a lot of funds where people put their money together, because you can't do commercial real estate on your own. I mean, these deals are massive, right? You know, I just closed a $76.5 million deal where Raytheon is the tenant, you know. The buyer of that deal is Dr. Xu. She owns Diamond Jamboree in Irvine.
Oh, wow.
But I told her, after we closed that deal, I told her, you made it when you're a Taiwanese immigrant and somehow you buy a property and a U.S. government defense contractor is paying you rent. You made it. This is
insane.
It's insane. So she didn't get that. I mean, these big groups have not, these big investors have not always bought these size deals. They started off much smaller. But what they do is they pool together and pool family money, friends' money. The Vietnamese have not really done that, because I represent some Vietnamese clients. They're not as large, but they're more individuals. What I want to do is bring Vietnam, the other groups have started their REITs, they've started funds to acquire commercial real estate or to co-op, to do bigger things together. But I want to change that. You know, we need to change that. We need to get together and
to leverage
and leverage and you know you have a lot more capital working together than alone. You know.
Okay. Let's just right. Yeah. Let's just get right to the point then. Let's just get right to this. Why this is not happening? Let's just get to it. Why can other communities do it? And why can't we do it? Why? Because the know-how is definitely there. The money is definitely there. All of it's there. And we have everything that the other communities have. But what don't we have that is holding us back from these deals? Why can't we get together?
I personally think is because Vietnam, we all came from a war, right? And in the whole history of Vietnam, Vietnam has been attacked by everybody. Right, every country has been there's been the French, you know, the Chinese, the Japanese, and then you know, it's been a war torn country, and you know when we all left there, we're very untrusting of others, of each other, of the government, of everything. So it's more protectionism than anything. I think at least for the first 30, 40 years here, I think everyone is just, you know, trying to survive and they compete against each other versus, you know, grouping together, you know, but I think it comes from the culture of always trying to fight a war or survive, you know, but I think it's been so long. Since that's, you know, I think we're at a point where we're gonna break out of that protection zone that we've been stuck in for so long, you know.
If you go deeper with that whole analogy, it's like when we were our grandparents were fighting on the French side against the other side, the Viet Minh. You had to play both sides, right?
Yeah.
There was constantly this like, well, are you Vietnamese or are you playing on the French team, right? So there's this constant like trust issue. And then you go into the U.S. war, U.S.
Same thing. Your same brother thing. Could be on that side or you're, right. You know, it's the same thing. It's like a civil war, right?
And you're always protecting your family secrets because you didn't want the Viet Cong to kind of know your family secrets. So everything was always very protected and information didn't flow. So that was bled into our generation, our second generation. So that's what you're saying, right?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. We're not trusting of each other. You know, we don't, when it comes to money, it's like, oh, I'm going to give somebody else my money so that they can make more money. I'm not going to do that. But you know what? That's how money is made. You know, that's how wealth is created, you know? I think hopefully we can break out of that very soon with more education. You know, the American system is very safe. You know, I mean, there's people can sue each other, and you know, it's not like the Wild Wild West. It's a good place to do business. You know. And that's why everyone comes here to do business. There's a lot of protection out there in the American system.
This episode is brought to you by Songkhai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018, Songkhai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkhai gin. Songkhai gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkhai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkhai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkhai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam. Now, are you working towards bringing groups of money together in our community? And if you are working on that, how is it going?
Yeah, you know, I've been a broker for 22 years, but in the last, 6 years, I've been kind of specializing on land deals. So I've been selling land to home builders like Lennar, KB Homes, Toll Brothers, things like that. Those are publicly traded companies, and they're basically, their business is to build homes. If they don't build homes, or they can't find land to build homes, and their stock goes down. So they're ravenous. These guys are hungry, and they're publicly traded, so they have capital markets. So they have a lot of capital. So I've been selling land to them, so I know exactly what they'll pay for it. And so when I find a property, like for instance, like Los Cabos, a 12-acre site, when I found that deal, I could have easily, brought it to Lennar or something like that. But instead, I teamed up with a company called Keystone. It's a company that's run by David Nguyen, Vietnamese home builder. He's probably the largest Vietnamese home builder there is. I think they've done like 30 projects, a lot in Huntington Beach, Fountain Valley, Buena Park. I actually bought one of his homes. In Huntington Beach, he built these 17, 5,000 square foot homes in Huntington Beach. They're beautiful. So his quality is up to the level of the home builders. So instead of selling it to Lennar, I basically partnered up with Keystone, and we purchased it because he's a developer, and so that partnership has kind of turned into a new company called Key Partners, where we have two business lines. One is kind of what I do, is to buy commercial real estate income property for cash flow, the existing income property like shopping centers and things like that, and add value to them either through repositioning or rezoning or adding mixed use components to it. Or the second business line is what kind of he does, is acquiring land or properties that we tear down and build homes on it. So, when you buy land and tear down, there's two levels of kind of added value. The first level is when you entitle the property. Let's say you entitle the property for 50 homes. Before you even put sticks on the ground, that stroke of a pen of approval from the city brings the property value this much higher. And then you can either decide to build it yourself. In the past, I couldn't build it myself because I'm not a builder, right? That whole process is mind-numbing, and David does that. Before, I would just sell it to Lennar, who would build it, right? But now I have, we can decide whether to build it or sell it to a home builder, because I have a partner that is both a developer, builder, and a general contractor. They're all in house. So that's our new kind of platform where all this requires capital. When we find an opportunity, we need capital. So we're raising funds to do those two kind of lines of business. And our target areas are basically local, dense infill areas that are very attractive to home builders.
And I can imagine if you go out to a community of wealthy Vietnamese people who have, spent years as lawyers and doctors and engineers, who are at the point where they can't afford to lose a few million bucks. Mm-hmm. How difficult is it to get people like that together to believe in you? Because I still live with that thought that Vietnamese people don't trust each other. And
yeah, it's true. But for instance, Los Cab, we purchased it for $27 million. We tied it up, and we basically raised the funds in 2 weeks. because it's not necessarily because of us, it's because of the real estate. So when they see the real estate, it's Fountain Valley, it's 12 acres of land. Where do you get that? So because we have rights to purchase the property, is a lot. The real estate sells itself. So I think that raising capital for a project is relatively easy if you have the right piece of property and the right opportunity. Raising funds to acquire property in the future is a little harder. So you have to have a lot of track record, and which I think we're with David and I, and he's built projects that you can touch and feel.
Yeah.
I think we're at that level, and with my track record, I think we're at that level where we can raise funds even prior to the project, because you have to be opportunistic, because when a deal comes, you have to kind of move fast. You can't raise funds every time because the sellers don't wait for you, and yet you're competing against other investors and people who want to buy the same deal. So hopefully we can get there, but I think we have good momentum.
Now there's got to be other organizations that are in your life. VNARP is a new one, but are there other Vietnamese professional organizations like Vietnamese attorneys or things that you know about?
Yeah, I used to be part of VAPA, the Vietnamese Association, the Bar Association, Vietnamese Bar Association. That's a really strong group. I don't practice law anymore, so I haven't gone to those meetings. But they have judges and the Vietnamese legal community has definitely progressed. There's my sister-in-law is a federal judge. To get to that level as Vietnamese immigrants is phenomenal, especially in the legal world, which I think that you have to be very good at articulation and reading and writing, and it's one of those things where like Asians aren't supposed to be good at, but I think that. That we made really good headway in the legal community.
When did you your path started to diverge and go into real estate versus law? What made you decide to take the other path?
Yeah, so when I got my license, I started in real estate transactional law. So I represented I basically did contract review for commercial real estate. So that's how I got exposed to commercial real estate. So I noticed that in a commercial real estate transactions, there's attorneys on both sides representing the buyer and seller, right? The attorney's role, and then I noticed there was a broker in the middle of it. There's a broker on the buyer side and a broker on the seller side. So I noticed that we had really different types of roles, the lawyer and the broker, right? The role of the broker was the deal maker. They brought the parties together to strike a deal, this is the price, let's agree to it. We get it into a letter of intent. And the attorneys take over and negotiate a purchase contract, right? But the role of the attorney is unusual because they get paid per hour. The brokers get paid on closing. They get paid nothing if the deal falls apart.
Yeah.
So the lawyer, I mean, I no offense to lawyers, I'm a lawyer myself, but in commercial transactions, the lawyer's role is to slow the deal down, is to define problems with the deal, right? To look at risk and things like that.
You gotta milk the deal.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm not saying all lawyers do that, but I'm saying that's kind of like the way the system's built. And the brokers want the deal to close. So I was looking at I want to be the deal maker. I don't want to be the deal breaker, right? So I've kind of always been a deal maker, even when I was like promoting nightclubs and things like that. I think that, I wanted to bring people together and make deals instead of slow them down. So that's kind of how I got into it. I decided, okay, I'm going to be a broker, you know, as a lawyer, you can just take the test. You don't have to do any courses and stuff like that. So I transitioned over pretty quickly.
But now when you're wearing a broker's hat, you're also thinking about the law and scrutinizing the deal, right? So does that slow you down more than a typical broker, or does it actually enhance the speed of which a deal is made because you understand the deal points?
I think it actually enhances, because when I can talk to the attorneys that are involved and I know what they're doing, and I know if they're being too picky or not, you know, or just trying to like be difficult. But I also know when it's legit, when it's a legit risk, and that helps my clients, because my clients know I have a legal hat on as well as a broker hat on. I can't really double dip, but they know I can look out for red flags on their behalf as a broker. So they know that I want to make the deal happen because it's opportunistic, because I'm a broker, but I'm going to keep them out of danger as well. So it definitely helps clients who are larger and needs a certain level of the commercial real estate industry is very legal. There's a lot of legal stuff that are involved, because when you buy a shopping center, there's literally 30 leases that you have to review, and you know, there's environmental reports and reciprocal easement agreements, and you know sharing parking and assets. It's a lot of legal work.
How important nowadays, you know, with the advent of AI, is going to law school to eventually do something like what you do? Is it a necessity? Can people reach your heights without the formal education, on the job training, being working alongside somebody like you, picking up the, you know, just with the 4-year degree, just kind of navigating?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
There's brokers in my industry that don't have they don't have any advanced education. Yeah. I mean, there's like things that you can get, like certifications like CCIM or SIOR, things like that. But that's more for education. But I think it's a very talent-based business.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a very talent-based business.
What do you mean by that? It means that you got to be good at what you do. But what kind of talents are you talking about?
You have to be really good with numbers. And you have to be really good with... I compare it to being like a stockbroker, but for real estate. You know, because commercial investments are basically, you have to look at cap rates. A cap rate is basically like a PE ratio for a stock,
yeah,
right? Or you have to be able to add value to a property. So can I raise the rents? You know, what's prohibiting me from raising the rents? Can I change the zoning? You know, that's basically like a stockbroker who picks Tesla and say, hey, how's Tesla gonna grow? You know, if I know the trajectory of their growth and I understand it, I can make a good educated guess. So a good stockbroker is talent based, right? That's why some of them that are really young are like in Wall Street killing it, and some never make it. It's a very talent-based business. So you pick the right real estate, you know how to add value to it. It's like picking the right stock and adding value to it.
Unbelievable. It's it's really fascinating to me, and I'm so glad that there are people like you in the Vietnamese community, that, because then it gives me a reason to, you know, because it's culture-based, I don't normally talk to business guys as much as the creative side. And mm-hmm. I'm finding that this is a very creative endeavor. The talent that you talk about with understanding the cap, would you say cap market versus P&E? Cap rate. These are all creative sort of parts of your brain that you have to kind of synthesize with all this information.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really fun, actually. Because at the end of the day, you're creating environments, you know, because people go shopping and people visit these homes and live in them and things like that. At the end of the day, it's actually you're creating environments that people use in their daily lives, you know.
You know, I've always wanted to know, like a center like the Grove in LA, the Americana in Glendale, the Citadel off the 5 on the way down to Orange County or up to LA, Irvine Spectrum, all of these sort of Disneyland-esque parks seem to have such a high dollar amount related to the investing of a place like that. Why don't most developers do that if they're so popular? Why aren't more of those sort of malls, open air malls, created like Century City? Why don't investors put more money into developing theme park like malls the way the examples that I described?
Well, I mean, you hit it right on the nail there. It's the capital, you know, right? So first of all, you have to have massive land to do that. And when you have massive land, you either have to be like the Irvine company, which owns the Spectrum, or, you know, in order to have massive land, you know, it's super capital intensive. I mean, I would rather just build homes on it, because the return on a massive land like that is much higher with building 1,000 homes on there versus a shopping center. I mean, just to be frank. But
I mean, what are we looking at? Like, is it like a much higher ratio, or is it just a few percentage points off annually?
No, it's much higher. It's much higher. But the thing is, you can't just build residential on certain pieces of land. You know, for instance, like cities need retail, right? Because of this tax revenue, right? They don't really get much revenue from homes. So they're not going to let you rezone everything to residential. But nowadays, with the housing shortage, you know, the California has relaxed laws where you can rezone commercial to residential. But you know, when you do that, they're hurting themselves. They're shooting themselves in the foot a little bit. In the past, before this whole housing crisis, it was impossible to rezone commercial to residential. So you have to. You can only build. You can only do retail or on commercially zoned property. So, you know, converting a mall into an open air is the best thing you can do. You know, if you own a retail property, but the cost of it is pretty large. You know, and you can only do it in certain areas, right? You know, for instance, they're redoing the Westminster Mall right now. That's going to be a group that I know pretty well is going to convert that into about 1,200 units of homes, they're going to keep some retail, but most of it is going to become residential. So the Westminster Mall is going to be a lot of it's going to be torn down pretty soon. For residential.
And there's so many malls across the country. I was in Missouri in the summertime, and there was a mall. There is a huge mall. You know, I roll into it, and I take my kids, and we're like, I'm like, I told my buddy, I was like, he's from Missouri. I was like, this is like dead. There's like, it's 50% occupancy. There's nobody here. And I turned to another lady who was in the little kids park inside the mall. And I said, hey, is this like typical traffic? And she's like, this is crowded. And I swear to God, man, like maybe 10, 15 people in this huge mall with all these closed. And it was the most depressing thing. And I actually wanted to talk to you about that. Trend throughout the country is happening because of, you know, Amazon taking over the retail space. What do people do? What do societies do once big malls like that close down? What can we do to repurpose and create new energy from it?
I mean, that's kind of like the big question that every developer is asking. But from my point of view, it's going to turn into mixed use. You know, it's going to turn into, you know, the residential portion. If it's in a good area where home prices are high and there's a high demand for housing like this area. For instance, Westminster Mall is going to kill it with 1,200 homes because those homes are going to sell. But in other areas where it's kind of like the housing is not as strong, it's harder to do. But if you can find a mall, you know, in denser areas, the best way to do it is convert it into mixed use and convert some of it to entertainment. Pickleball is becoming pretty large. Like people are converting former like Macy's into pickleball arenas, right? So entertainment, sports, experience centric shopping centers, where it's like before it was movies, but you know the movie industry is suffering quite a bit with Netflix and all that stuff.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, but now it's a lot of like kids parks and water slides, and you know, people still need to take their kids on a daily basis somewhere. You know, so anything sports related, anything water parks or you know, a pickleball, or with a mixture of housing, where you kind of like more like the urban, where you can get out of your house and go walk over to you know, and a lot of it is going to be converted to eateries, right? You know, so food halls and breweries and things like that. If you go to Diamond Jamboree, my client that owns that has done really well. It's basically a gigantic food court. It's what Diamond Jamboree is, and it's packed all the time.
Yeah.
And crazy. If you look at in Little Saigon, you know, the only things that really are attractive in Little Saigon are the restaurants.
Yeah.
Right. So people go to Little Saigon to eat. You know, they may go for events for Thut and Futaw to buy, you know, to more like for experience, but most of it is to eat. Like me and you are going to go to Little Saigon to eat.
Yeah. And speaking of Futaw, which is such an iconic place on the map, what would you do differently to that place? I mean, if we're just speaking out of sort of like riffing in terms of creativity, what would you do to that place?
Honestly, I would model it. I mean, Frank Zhao, I know Frank Zhao, and he's done wonders with Futaw to be the pioneer to create it. But in my opinion, I would kind of mirror what Diamond Jamboree has done and bring some high level of, you know, just up the game on high level restaurants. And that, you know, if, you know, so the restaurants at Diamond Jamboree are national restaurants that are from different areas of the world. And they just have higher quality, you know. So up the restaurants, because people go to eat.
Yeah,
you know, you know, I think I would have modeled it after Diamond Jamboree, you know. Diamond Jamboree has the highest rents in Irvine. This is phenomenal what she's done over there.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool to see if Frank does move in that direction. I don't know why. I
mean, if you've seen like on the Brookhurst and Edinger Center where Brodart is.
Yeah.
I forget the key group, the
key concept,
key concept. They've upped their game on restaurants. So if you bring kind of those concepts into Futaw and make it really high end and modern, it has to be modern. Then the young people will come, because the young people love to eat. You know, they love the experience and they love hanging out with their friends and having drinks. So a mixture of bars and restaurants and entertainment.
But you would have to revamp the whole place, because, you know, then you
have expensive.
Kiosks that are just selling toys randomly in the hallway.
Yeah.
That's a tricky. You know, there's a charm to it, an old world charm to it, but there's also sort of, you know, you can do it like Diamond Jubilee, but you can't have both.
Yeah, you have to either one or the other. You can't have like the little stand up selling toys or and have like a super high end restaurant next to it.
Can't do it.
Yep.
And I think that that's sort of like where I stand at the intersection of like the old school charm versus like the modern, like how do we up our brand as Vietnamese Americans? Little Saigon is the capital of, you know, the population outside of Vietnam. So we don't have anything that anchors like Jubilee Plaza. We don't have that other than Phu Lộc Thọ, but there is a time and place and a time in the point of our history where it's got to go the other way.
And I've actually brokered a lot of Little Saigon's properties, like I've always encouraged the new buyers to revamp those centers. Hasn't happened yet, but hopefully soon.
Yeah. How often do you go back?
They're all very dated. Yeah.
Yeah, they're all very dated. How often do you go back to Vietnam?
I haven't been back in like 8 years, and I haven't gone much at all. But I from what I hear, there's Vietnam is like a whole new level than it used to be. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting. You know, I think Vietnam is benefiting from the whole COVID thing and the anti-Chinese embargoes, and so a lot of business has gone to Vietnam, and they're flourishing. You know, so that's as much as I know about it. Yeah.
But the legal contracts are probably the thing that inhibits you working there the most, isn't it?
Yeah, I haven't. You know, people somehow assume that when I sell these shopping centers in Little Saigon, that I sell them to Vietnamese, because they think that only people in Vietnam have that kind of money. It's not true at all. I've never sold a shopping center to a Vietnamese from Vietnam.
Yeah.
They're all, people don't realize that the Vietnamese here have a ton of money. You know, I'm sure the people in Vietnam have a lot of money too. But basically all my trades have been local buyers. I don't visit much, so I'm probably the not the person to ask about the Vietnamese market. Although there are investors, from what I know, are looking in the U.S. to kind of safeguard their capital. Yeah. But I haven't worked with them directly, so.
Yeah, it's going to be a changing landscape. And I know it's a little bit taboo to even entertain these thoughts of like working with Vietnamese nationals that bring money over from their side of the world. But I think eventually I hope that we all are able to, you know, benefit from each other's relationships.
Yeah. 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 I mean, at the end of the day, we're all Vietnamese, right?
It's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Tom, thank you so much for spending time today with me. You know, it's been a long time that we connected in this way, and I appreciate you having a willingness to be very open and sharing all this information with me.
Yeah, you know, your podcast is great. I mean, it's a really good thing that you're doing. You know, with these conversations you're having, just on the business and creative side, is really cool. It's really cool, and I think it's helping the community quite a bit.
Thank you. And you know, I know a lot of people that know you, and I've known you since the college days, and tracking your progress, I've always wondered, and I thank God that I have this platform that I can go to you directly and really spend this time and have the future where there's more opportunity to sit and talk on another podcast with you about, you know, there's a lot of things that we covered that I want to get more into details with you.
Awesome. Yeah. I would love to share it. You know, people need to know.
Thanks, Tom. I really appreciate it. Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.